Hostepper, welcome to the Black Sheep Experience. This is episode number 16. That's right, man, 16 episodes in, rolling right along. How you guys doing today, man? Thanks for hanging out, dude. This is a great podcast today. I've got a guest on with me, which we'll jump into that in just a few moments. A couple of things before we dive in. First of all, for those of you that listen faithfully, thank you so much. Man, I love hanging out with you every week, talking about some of the things I'm learning, some of the things you've said, offering, you know, some of these guests like I have today, and just trying to sift through some of the stuff, right? And yeah, man. So thank you for those of you that have followed us on Instagram, follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook. Man, that's a big deal, and I really appreciate you guys being out there. You know, especially those of you that comment and all that. Man, totally. Yeah, I really appreciate that. So, for those of you that haven't done that stuff yet, man, it takes like, what, 10 seconds, 15 maybe? Jump online, The Black Sheep Experience, or on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Find me on there and follow, like, whatever. And yeah, dude, do that. It really actually makes a big difference. So, yeah, that would be awesome. And shout out to me. Let me know that you're out there. I always love to see that. So, so listen, here's a way that you can help if you're enjoying the podcast. It's not financial, right? Not asking for money. Now, if you want to send me money, I mean, I'll take your money. But that's not what I'm asking. If you would just, on your social media stuff, man, if you hear a podcast that you like, share it on there. Or just share the podcast, period. Hey, I'm listening to this guy, you know, this is decent, whatever. Man, that makes a huge difference. And, yeah, I would really appreciate that. Just takes a minute, let your friends know what you're listening to. I don't have a budget, you know, to do like, plus the sponsored ads. I don't know. It always seems weird. So, yeah, so I don't do any of that. The best way to let people know or to help me is just letting your friends know, you know, word of mouth, right? Right from you. Hey, I'm listening to this podcast. It's awesome. Check it out. I would really appreciate your help with that. It makes a big difference too, by the way. Okay. Lots of stuff coming up in the future. We will deal with that next week, perhaps. But today I got a guy on named Kent Dobson. If you're not familiar with Kent, this guy is an awesome guy, man. Very cool dude. Had a great time talking to him. He's got a couple of things that I think are interesting. First of all, he's got the NIV, First Century Study Bible. I think that's what it's called. Yeah, so I downloaded this thing to my iPad, my iPhone. Man, it is awesome. I've had it for quite some time now. I love it. And it's just this the NIV Bible, but it's got all this cultural information attached to it and word studies and some stuff like that. It's really excellent, man. Check that out. I think you'd enjoy that. Also, he's got a book that he authored called Bitten by a Camel, and it's also just an excellent book. You should check that out. I love that book. Kent Dobson's a cool dude, man, and he does these tours to Israel as well. He was the former pastor of the Mars Hill Church. He does a lot of these, some group studies and things like that. I mean, the guy is just, and he's just brilliant, man. So, if you're not familiar with him, check out those books. Go to KentDobson.com. This is one of those good guys. This is one of those real gems, and you don't want to pass this dude up. All right, man, so that's who I've got on today. You know what? Let's just jump in there and hear what Kent has to say.
Mm-hmm. right, everybody. I am excited because on the Black Sheep Experience today, we have just this incredible guy, Kent Dobson. And he, well, he was former pastor of Mars Hill. He's got several books like the NIV First Century Bible, and then he's got Bitten by a Camel. And so this is going to be a great podcast. And so let's welcome Kent. Thanks for being on, man.
Hey, appreciate it.
Hey, man. Yeah, absolutely, dude. I just love your stuff, and so I'm really interested to hear some of the things that you have to say. So here's a little bit of my background. I was a Assemblies of God pastor, and was just kind of struggling, and you may be able to appreciate some of this, was just kind of struggling with the whole, all the politics and all the, just the stuff that goes along with the red tape part of it all. And then on top of that, I started dealing with some of the tougher issues, like people burning in hell and, all these things. They just started becoming these huge questions for me, man. And I found out pretty quick that those questions aren't welcome at all. And so I've read Bitten by a Camel, and I know that your experience is a little different, but yet it's there's some similarities. So wherever you'd like to start your story, I'm ready to hear what you got to say, man.
Yeah, I don't know where could I start? I mean, I think I grew up in the South in Virginia, at a place called Thomas Road Baptist Church. This is Jerry Falwell's church. My dad worked for Jerry Falwell. So I had a kind of unusual brand of evangelical / fundamentalist Christianity in that not only was it relatively rigid and certain about its ideas, it was also kind of like before there were mega churches, before that was a term, it was a mega church. And wrapped up in politics and kind of the moral majority back in the 80s, trying to convince Christians to vote. I remember, obviously I was just a kid, but I remember after services, you could register to vote.
Wow.
Which was like kind of like a revolutionary idea at the time. A real mixing of church and state, I suppose. But as a kid, I just was whatever, doing kid things, messing around, playing on the playground. So that was sort of like my introduction to Christianity, and there was loads of hell and threats and a lot of witnessing or being witnessed to, a lot of revivals, making threatening people with hell and making decisions for Christ. So
right.
I would not say that sat super well with me even as a kid. I mean, I was I felt like probably one part of me had one foot in and one foot out most of my life, or I would kind of go back and forth. But eventually I went to Liberty University, which is Jerry Falwell's college. That's also where my dad worked when I was young, and kind of was back in that scene. But after I graduated, I was an English major. After I graduated, that was within 6 months is when Mars Hill in Grand Rapids started. So Rob Bell worked for my dad, and my dad had a church up here in Michigan where I'm living now. And I just sort of got hooked into this strange thing that was emerging called Mars Hill, and I ended up doing the music for a few years before I moved to Israel. And also, probably at this time, I was asking the most serious questions about faith. Instead of just sort of being uncomfortable with, I don't like being threatened with hell, and I don't really agree with all these moral standards, or I don't hold to them in the way I'm supposed to hold to them, I started asking real questions about what is Christianity, where did it come from, who is Jesus? What the hell is the Bible? Even though I knew a lot of the stories, I really didn't know what kind of book it was and how to use it and if it really was meaningful. So I spent a few years in Israel in graduate school and eventually came back and took the job at Mars Hill when Rob left for California. So that's like a drive-through. I mean, there's a lot more to say, but that's like a bio, I guess.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is that you grew up in, I guess, such a fundamentalist type of setting. So, yeah. You know, for me, I didn't grow up in a particularly religious home, but my wife and I got, you know, saved in a like a real hardcore Pentecostal setting. And so we just became like, you know, hardcore fundamentalists and you know, didn't even really understand half the verses that we were holding on to, quite frankly. And then, you know, you start to ask questions, and so we went from that. It was like a oneness Pentecostal type thing. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but so we went from that, and we kind of slid into the to the Assemblies of God, which is still a Pentecostal type setting. But then some of those bigger questions, like the ones you're talking about, you know, well, what's interesting, I guess, to me is that, and I know you've got all this information, man, and so it's hard for me to pick out what I want to get from you. But when you start to have those questions, that's actually kind of scary. You know, to gain your footing and to feel like you've got some type of, you know, if you're fundamentalist, you have all this foundation. And when you start to pull blocks out of that, you know, it's hard to fill those with, I guess, you know, a different type of foundation. Does that make sense?
It does. And that's a lot of people's experience. And that's a bit of mine, but I found it more exhilarating. I was so fed up with Christianity that I had been raised in, some of it is just that's part of the adolescent psycho-spiritual state. It's an important way of growing up. You have to get fed up with kind of what you've been force-fed if you want to sort of go on your own journey. So, but I found it exhilarating, like diving into these questions, and in some ways I think because right when Mars Hill was like getting huge and popular and, you know, thousands of people are coming each week, I moved to Jerusalem. And it's almost like I had a hiatus from roles and expectations around what do you really believe and, what answer would you give for fill in the blank? I didn't have to deal with that. I was in graduate school, and Israel is a wild place to live and difficult. And of course, questions are not off limits in the academic setting. The professors don't even care what you believe. So I found like I was able. That's what I meant by exhilarating. Jumping into historical Jesus questions, and it was troubling because I didn't know where this was going. I didn't know if, like, next month I'd be an atheist or if I would convert to Judaism. It was like things were, there's some personal disorientation. It didn't come with as much fear as other people experience, at least at the beginning.
Mm. So how did you, so things like hell, for instance, or, you know, the whole thing about, like, you know, the slippery slope and, you know, in the last days, people are going to be deceived. I mean, all those type of fear-based things, what, you just kind of left those behind?
Well, it's a tough question to answer because, I think what happened to me over time is some of those real basic stories stopped having a grip on me.
Mm-hmm.
I can even write a bit about that in Bitten by a Camel. I remember the threat of hell, which is as old as my memory of church. I mean, right from the beginning as a kid, where we were invited to imagine people burning and being tortured, which is a terrifying thing. But just like with any kind of, I don't know, stimuli, if you get too much of it, it just loses its power. And that's what happened to me. I just, like, this does not, I am not afraid of this anymore. But I can't say exactly when that happened, that particular one with hell. But by the time I was in college, I was like, this is not, whether or not it exists is not really even that interesting to me. And then I started to think, once I started to getting kind of under the surface of how these things emerged and how they were literalized, it started making a lot more sense to me. Like, oh, so I think it just sort of lost its power. And same with the end time stuff. I cannot tell you. I mean, I was terrified as a kid. Every time I couldn't find my parents, I'm like, oh, the rapture happened. But I just was like, this is... And I think one thing that helped is I started meeting other kinds of Christians. I think that's part of the problem with kind of the subculture of evangelical Christianity. I know it's kind of a broad term, like exactly evangelical Christianity, but you don't really meet many Catholics or Orthodox people or whatever, fill in the blank.
Yeah.
And I just started meeting people that didn't believe these most basic things, like even in Orthodox Christianity, they don't even believe in original sin. It's not one of their tenets. I was like, this is so, how can this even be Christianity? And it sort of softened, in a way, it broadened my horizons for what is this global thing around the person of Christ.
Mm.
Way bigger than I thought. But it lessened the anxiety. It's like, oh, people have been interpreting these things in kind of vastly different ways during different centuries. So calm down a little bit. Was sort of what I was telling them. So calm down a little bit and realize you don't know very much about your own faith tradition, which was true.
Yeah, that's a huge thing. In your book, you talk, in Bitten by a Camel, you talk about, and I'm going to blow these, and I used these terms in a podcast early on, and somebody sent me a hateful email because I didn't say them correctly, but there's codiphotic and apophotic, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's all within the history of Christianity. Now, I know we're like a very westernized type of, belief system here, but Christianity really has a huge, broad spectrum of history behind it with a lot of different ideas and views. Could you expound upon that maybe a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I can, but I don't know to... It could also take all day, and I barely know anything. One of the things I learned in graduate school, when I started taking courses on early Christianity, was, first of all, there was no such thing as early Christianity. It was Christianities, if you even want to call it that. And even before that, it was just a sect of Judaism. And it's almost impossible to say what that sect believed and who they thought Jesus was. And when you couple that with the complexity of the Roman world at the time, so you have Greek is a common language, but it's not understood in the same way in different regions. So if you're in Egypt, and really Greek is kind of like a second language, perhaps, how might you understand these texts that you've been handed? Well, same with if you're in Syria, or you're in Asia Minor, or you're in Rome, and which is actually kind of cool that something existed that was more like a movement, more like an underground movement, and they were reading these texts, and probably some texts that we don't have anymore, trying to make sense of it, but not really so much building a religion. I mean, that came a lot later. I mean, just sort of like trying to be this kind of living organism as it sort of was coming into being in these different geographical regions. But eventually that led to all kinds of, sort of divides in a way. You had a kind of Gnostic Christianity, you had a certain kind of Christianity in Egypt and Syria, and there was something in Palestine or Israel and Asia Minor and Rome, and they start to take on these different nuances. But a whole area area that I was unfamiliar with would be Eastern Orthodox Christianity, which never sort of left its Aramaic origins. Like, it's more Middle Eastern and even more mystical origins. A lot of Orthodox Christianity, and there are different branches, obviously, but have a much more mystical way that they view Christ, whereas what became Western Christianity was, in a way, a lot more politicized, a lot more centered in Rome, a lot more about control and doctrine and power. And I'm making some generalizations, but again, I just was like so surprised to find out all this stuff. And I mean, honestly, I thought there was Jesus and then the disciples, and then a lot of people got things wrong for a long time. Those were called Catholics, and then but thankfully people in the 1950s in the South figured it out, and now we're the, you know, the true followers of Jesus that are getting back to how it always was. I mean, that was really like my view of Christianity. It just like started with Jesus and skipped about 1700 years, and here we are. So
yeah, like the Dark Ages lasted for centuries and centuries, and then, you know, thank God we came along and you know, steered the ship back to the right course.
That's yeah, exactly, and we started reading the Bible the right way and all this stuff, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And another kind of cool thing, I'm not really an early Christian scholar, to tell you the truth, but I started reading, because I had to in class, I started reading how ancient people were interpreting the Bible, and I was like floored. It's like, I mean, Augustine and some of these other early Christian writers, especially the ones that were more prone to read the Bible as allegory, would be thrown out of seminary. They would not make it through Dallas Seminary or whatever it's called, or like the real movie Bible Institute. They'd be thrown out. And I was like, oh, this is so cool. The Bible, first of all, became a lot more interesting to me during this time. And I realized, whoa, people have interpreted this thing way differently than I was taught, and would like just look at me kind of oddly if I asked them, do you believe this is literally true? And I'd say, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Anyway,
this is my own expanding.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I had the same experience, and I didn't. Most of my, all of my, you know, what we would call seminary type of teaching was through the Assemblies of God, and it was all basically their stuff, you know? And so you get out and you start, you know, I mean, like the, and I don't know if you say apophatic or apathetic or how that's supposed to be said, but...
I say apophatic, but whatever. I don't
yeah, whatever, that. Whatever. Right, right. But you got this whole group of people that are like, okay, a lot of our belief system is based on what we don't know about God. And as a Western guy, you're like, wait a second, but we have the Bible. We know everything there is to know about God, you know? It's all boxed and it's all perfect and it all makes sense. And then you realize throughout history, that hasn't always been the case. So, and I know you've told this story a million times, but I'd love to talk about when you were bitten by the camel and what that meant to you, I guess, spiritually, because that was also a huge, I don't know if it was an emotional or mental or I know it was certainly spiritual, but that had a pretty big impact on you as well.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, just to provide a tiny bit of context, so I'm in Israel. I'm about to finish one graduate program, and I'm considering another one, or coming back to the States and kind of returning to Marsville or doing something back in church world. But I still was like back and forth, like, is this real? Am I really even a part of this? Am I really even a Christian? But I don't know anything else. I don't, the problem with me maybe you resonate with this too. The problem with sort of committing your life to knowing and understanding and teaching and the Bible or being involved in church world, you don't really have a resume beyond that.
Right.
It doesn't transfer very well to other careers, and all my connections were with inside the Christian world. And but I was also, in a way, very fragile and open. Fragile might not be the best word for it, but the short story is I had in my mind very quietly and to myself, of course I finally put it in the book, but to myself, I was going to climb Mount Sinai, which I was there for a class, and I was going to ask God, like, what should I do? Like, help me. Like, genuinely give me some insight, give me some direction. I don't even know if you work this way. I don't even know if you are real in the way I've always understood that to be, but I need some help. I'm desperate. And so I fasted. I tried to, at least, and I tried to prepare myself to, I don't know, for just a hint. You know, I wasn't, maybe there's a, if you think about your own, one of the things I think that's great about the Pentecostal movement in general is that there's some experience. Now, you could say, well, what exactly is that experience? But there's an experiential component to faith. But the non sort of Pentecostal world that I come from, it's much more about belief, head, believing the right things, and not doubting those things. And maybe, if you're really lucky, you can have an experience. But I wouldn't count on it, an experience of God.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I was asking for, like just a hint, a nudge, a clue, something like that. But instead, the entire experience was completely unlike what I thought. Mount Sinai is kind of like a tourist trap, or like a carnival. It's like a carnival of tourism in a way, even though it's in this wildly remote place. And instead of like some sort of divine encounter, or what I thought would be a divine encounter should be, I was bitten by a camel at the top of the mountain. So what's funny is that, and I tried to say this in the book, maybe I didn't do a very good job, that was not like, that went into, in a way it went into my unconscious. I didn't even want to sort of admit that that's what happened to me. I didn't come down the mountain and say, you never believe what happened to me. I was bitten by a camel, and I was asked God to do it. Instead, I got thrown around like a dog with a chew toy, which is really what happened to me. I just didn't want to talk about it. I didn't want to tell anybody. And so it kind of went underground. And I think what happened very slowly over time, over the next 5 or 6 years, I started realizing that there was something about Israel, something about this bite that was shifting my worldview slowly. Like I was about to leave a country, or had left a country, and I was going to cross a border, and I was going to enter another country. And I wasn't sure what the train was like, or what the language was, and how to move about. I knew the old one, but in a way it was a kind of initiatory experience, but one that was not full of revelation, but rather sort of disappointment, disillusionment, mm-hmm. confusion, a lot of loneliness. When you live in Jerusalem and you come back, people are like, that must have been amazing. Like, were you closer to God there? I mean, what are you supposed to say to that?
Right.
First of all, that doesn't even work. How could you even have such a theology? Like, I mean, as if God like hangs out over there and not other places. But it's hard to say no. Actually, it was completely disorienting. It tore apart everything I knew about the Bible and left me just kicked me out into some new territory, and now I'm kind of wandering around. That's more what it was like.
Yeah. As I read through the book, and you know, you talk about, I mean, I had no idea that, first of all, camels, obviously they're a huge animal, but I had no idea they could be so vicious, you know, and who would think that? But then, you know, I guess for me, the way it hit me was, and so many spiritual experiences are that way, and some people aren't going to like this probably, but you know, you're looking to have some type of an encounter that answers some of those questions, especially whenever you're just, I mean, you do, I think a lot of people do get to that point of desperation, like, God, I just need you to, you know, you got to heal mom, or you got to, you know, whatever. I mean, we all have those moments. And then, you know, essentially you're bitten by whatever that avenue of hope was, and you have to sort of like find a way to process that. And I think that for most of us, we just chalk it up to, you know, well, God knows best, you know, the Lord knows best, and this is His will type of thing. And for me, you know, and again, man, I, you know, I'm not trying to be like weird and disrespectful, but like I have a lot of friends who are, their faith is pretty rigid. It's pretty, I guess, constructed. And so one of their ideas is, you know, God is in complete control of everything. And He knows best, and His plan is best. And so one of the big falling outs I had over this was, you know, a few years ago, we had all these hurricanes, and there was this story about a two-year-old that was found in floodwaters clinging to its dead mother. And so the two-year-old was alive, but the mother was dead. But, you know, you can just imagine the scene. It's horrific. And I'm just like, no, you know what? I'm not going to excuse God for that. That sucks. And so either he, even to the point of, I guess, I don't know where I'm at with that now, but exactly, but somehow all of these things, like, that can't possibly be God's plan. I think one of the things that you said was, it cannot be true that God is less loving than I am. So, we, you know, we're not unintelligent. I mean, we have brains, and anybody can look at that and say, okay, well, whoever allows that or whoever plans that, that's just cruel. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I mean, that what you're describing was really a philosophical thorn or bone in my throat. Probably going back as soon as I became probably an adolescent or something, I was so uncomfortable with the will of God. I mean, and just people toiling over it. What is it? And what does He want? Always a He. Yeah. And His plan, and anything inexplicable was like, well, His ways are higher than my ways. Now, I will say, I understand that sentiment. We are human. What do any of us know, really? But that just became like unpalatable over time. I could not continue. I would rather not just say I'm an outright atheist or an agnostic than to believe that somehow God is a master puppeteer. I mean, I think just the way the world is, reality itself is always there's always tension between chaos and order. Mm-hmm. Between logos, that's order, and chaos, or eros, even. That's fiery, uncontrollable, which is also associated with love, and order, and logos, and reason. And I mean, this is at the very heart of reality itself. And whatever God is, I mean, I suppose you could say, is the sum total of all these inexplicable forces. But the idea of like a master clockmaker up there that is either wound the thing up or is, you know, or puppeteer pulling the strings here and there, decides to help the two-year-old, but not the mother. I just can't. That's far too rigid of a view of God. I'm just not there. Nope, there's no way. And somewhere, actually, Judaism really helped me with this, because Judaism does not have the same view of kind of God's will, so to speak. It's really different. Even Elie Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor, he has a play where the people of the town put God on trial based on the rules of the Talmud and the Bible itself, and God loses. They find God to be the loser.
Wow.
And to be unjust. And that's the conclusion of the play. Now, that's Judaism at its most beautiful and also terrifying, that they're willing to challenge, like, the 20th century is, I don't see how you can come out of the 20th century into the 21st century and say, well, God kind of had a plan with, for my graduate program, and kind of orchestrated these circumstances, but he was kind of too busy during the Holocaust. He was like thinking about something else. I don't know. I just, no way. Like, I think that is just not something, not an area that I'm willing to go anymore. So,
yeah, the obvious conclusion is, you have this, I mean, let's say an 11-year-old that gets, kidnapped and then becomes a sex slave, and that's how this, human being exists for, 10, 15 years or whatever, and then, dies somehow. And so you're supposed to somehow, just say, well, the same thing you said earlier, God's ways are not our ways, and for some reason this was part of the plan. It's like, no, man, that sucks. That is cruel. No, Yeah, how could that, it's funny, especially with the issue of hell, and man, everybody, I have so many people that, I've lost friends over some of this stuff,
Me too.
Yeah, it's weird, dude, but like in any other context, this thing with hell or the idea of, if I don't do the will of God, my life's going to fall apart. I mean, in any other context, it's like an abusive relationship. You know what I'm saying? You tell anybody else, imagine you got to get out of that.
Imagine if you treat your spouse that way. Yeah. Imagine if you treat your spouse that way. You have to rigidly obey everything that I say, otherwise we can't have a relationship. And as soon as we can't have a relationship, not only is it over, I'm going to torture you. That's most people's conception of God, honestly, at the most base level. And that's not even the story in the Bible. That's what's so ironic. And that's not really... Christianity is too big of a thing. It's been around too long, so you can't even say its view is fill in the blank. There are various views on various things. However, there are all kinds of alternatives to that sort of really mean and abusive dictator or dad, that's not only willing to torture his son, but anybody else who steps out of line. I understand the notion of justice. That's where a lot of this stuff is rooted. Like, if you go on the archetypal level, the symbolic level, there is something called justice. And whatever we conceive of the divine to be, in our various ways, we want that divinity to have some sense of justice, what's right and what's wrong. But we automatically conclude that wrong then has to be... we literalize the sort of punishment of that and end up imagining a being that's going to torture people. I just, like, no way. For me, I mean, I understand. I'm not trying to... I'm already a heretic, so this is really...
Yeah, exactly.
You're being a heretic. I say, okay, fine. I'm not interested in trying to prop something up there, but... and that's what's so sad. I mean, I think Christianity... and even if you want to just say the way of Jesus, is there are some harsh things about it. I realize that, but its primary message still seems to be love of neighbor and even love of nature, reality itself. And that's just absent from the more. It's not totally absent, but it tends to be more absent from the more rigid views of fundamentalism. So.
I was somebody, I was listening to a podcast the other day, and I don't recall who it was now, but they talked about how, a lot of, particularly, I guess, here in the States, our idea is, well, God's going to destroy this thing anyway, so, my care and concern for the earth isn't all that important. And some of the other, I won't even call them Christian faiths, but, things outside of that. More like some earth-based type religions, who pay attention to just the beauty of solstices, equinoxes, the air around them, the plants, the, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's almost like reconnecting to being a human being, which isn't a horrible thing.
No. I'm starting to get excited because earth-based religion is what the biblical religion was. It was totally and deeply rooted in the earth itself. All seven Jewish festivals are earth festivals, connected to the moon, connected to the seasons, connected to the harvest. You can't even understand Passover or Jesus's death and resurrection without being deeply intertwined with the cycles of the earth. There was no disconnection. And that's what Genesis, that's what the first chapter says. It is good, it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good. That's the major conclusion. That's the opening line of the Bible. But somehow, apocalyptic thinking, which is when people say God's going to destroy this thing, not only do they not know, not only do I think that's false, but it's a complete misreading of what apocalyptic literature is. They fundamentally misunderstand the actual text, Revelation itself, or other such texts that sometimes get associated with, like the Book of Daniel. They don't understand the literature. And I would go toe-to-toe with someone on this particular thing. It's a total misreading. Apocalyptic literature is symbolic language for the destruction and renewal of culture itself, of the way things are, and they use the largest possible terms, heaven and earth, because that's what it really would be, a collapse and renewal of the whole way of being of the entire Roman Empire. The only way to talk about that on the largest scale possible is to talk about the destruction of the earth and angels and going out and causing plagues. That's exactly what happened with the Roman Empire in terms of its own unraveling and dismantling and its power-hungry system based on dividing everyone into slaves, taxed people, or the elite was eventually going to unravel. And it's just sad. It's really sad. That's one of the things that when I was a kid, the people at Liberty and at Thomas Rogan Place, they were really, really into writing about the Book of Revelation. And my dad has a book, 21 Reasons Why Jesus, it's a funny title, 21 Reasons Why Jesus Might Come Back Before the Year 2000. I mean, it's just that's hilarious, like, out in the title of a book.
Yeah.
21 like, Reasons Why.
Late Great Planet Earth type stuff.
It's just kind of funny. But anyway, but it's a fundamental misreading. I can't even think of a contemporary parallel, but it's like looking at Van Gogh's painting of sunflowers and then reading a Wikipedia entry of how sunflowers grow and think they're saying the same thing. One is an artistic impression of something, and the other are facts about how sunflowers grow. They're just like two completely different genres, but we've taken these apocalyptic stories and literalized them, much to our terrible... It has wreaked and is wreaking currently terrible havoc on the earth because we didn't know how to read the language. It's really sad.
Yeah, and it's so... I think, you know, honestly, it's kind of... it's almost like an emotional abuse, really, you know, because you spend your whole life, and you were talking about this earlier, you spend your whole life like... making sure you don't do something, you know, so you don't miss the rapture. Or, I mean, I can remember, the conversations of, okay, let's say I'm a Christian my whole life, and then I cuss and get in a car wreck. What happens? Oh, well, you go to hell. No, you go to heaven, you know, and you have this, like, big, weird debate over this really shallow, what would have to be, like, this really weird, shallow God. I don't know, man. For me, I'll be 50 next year, so I've learned, man, being alive is hard. It's really hard, man. And you know, you're faced with so many decisions that you think, okay, based on the best information I have right now, I'm going to do this. And then maybe a year later, you realize, you know, man, that maybe that wasn't the best thing. But now somehow I got to figure out all this stuff to secure my eternity. To me, it just seems like, I don't know. I don't trust myself with my diet, much less, you know, eternal life.
Yeah. And I can't imagine that there's a deity out there that's going to peer into your mental belief system like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, this is the real gift and also dread of depth psychology, you know, that has revealed what ancient people always knew was there, was that there's a deep unconscious, and much of what we claim on the surface of our lives is the tip of an iceberg. When people say, I believe this, I know I believe this, I know I believe this, a lot of that stuff, my friend Peter Rollins says, usually that means they don't believe any of those things, especially like the more insistent they are, because that's consciousness fixates, the ego fixates on what it thinks it can control, what it thinks it knows, but there is a vast underground labyrinth. It's the tip of an iceberg. Most of the body of who we are is under the surface.
Mm.
And to say that, you know, God is just looking at the tip of this iceberg, what we're claiming we believe, and then somehow is going to use that information to eternally judge our whereabouts in some afterlife, this is not very interesting to me. I think most people, take any relationship that you have, like your marriage, you have a spouse, you have a best friend, when you're sitting across the table from them, really, if you're really, really honest, that person is a mystery.
Hmm.
They really are. They're a total mystery. You think you know them, but you know deep down you really don't. That's also how we are with ourselves. We're a mystery to ourselves. Our beliefs, our values, our motivations, they are a mystery. And that's part of the great invitation of just growing up, making conscious more of what's bubbling up from the underground. But when you try to suppress all that stuff down with very rigid beliefs, I just know this, you end up not growing up and end up becoming, most of the time, a rigid and small person, as an old person who's still angry. And the natural flow of life, where you would grow into widening circles and greater realms of inclusion, like the life of Jesus, starting off in a small little village in Nazareth, and eventually including all kinds of disciples, and then women, and then out from there, and then Gentiles, and then people with leprosy. I mean, that seems to be what a healthy spiritual life looks like, and you can't say that of a lot of contemporary Christian circles. It becomes more and more angry and rigid and fearful, and it's circling the drain instead of, I live my life in widening circles.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because so much, I think, you know, your first century NIV Bible, which is just phenomenal. I was smart enough to buy it like on iBooks, so I can just like highlight and paste stuff, you know. It's so brilliant, man, and so many things I think get lost just in not understanding what was happening culturally. And I know I'm like talking to, you know, to the master here basically, but so many of those things, you know, you're talking about women or, you know, the leprosy and, you know, if you had a context, tax collectors and how they were actually viewed, you know, that wasn't as much about evangelism as it was about inclusion. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, reaching out to this guy that everybody really hated.
Yeah, and it's destroying the us versus them mentality, and behind that is a kind of theology. God likes people who are healthy and not people who are unhealthy. Many Americans, we just pick on Americans, and I probably like this too much in some respects, God likes people like me.
Yeah.
And anyone else not like me, if they're ill or they're an immigrant or they're poor, must be their own fault, and they must be punished by God. Now, a lot of us won't admit that, but that's rooted in really early stage ego consciousness. You know, junior high, adolescent, versus them, who's on my team, who's on the good team and who's on the bad team, who's the nerd, who's the cool kid, we're still operating like that, and a lot of that we're calling theology. And I think, by the way, I mean, I have mixed feelings about talking about the Bible, because I'll sometimes go back and forth, like, no, it's definitely what we should be talking about, and sometimes I'm like, that is the thing that's in the way. But I think more recently, here's a belief I have, that the biblical narrative, the stories, the Jesus narrative, Moses, are deep inside the collective Western psyche. Even if people claim they're not religious, or they're spiritual but not religious, or they don't want anything to do with religion, in the collective psyche, it's a part of our story. It's part of who we are. It's part of how America was founded, with manifest destiny. You know, these are deep, that is deeply rooted in a certain image of the Bible and the promised land and what God is giving people. And so it's in the water, so to speak. And so I think, given that, we have some responsibility to look again at what's informing us on the level of the collective psyche and at the actual text itself. And we probably need to look at it in three really important ways. One is, what does the story actually say? I remember, like, I don't listen to many preachers anymore, but a lot of what qualifies as preaching is telling people what certain words mean in a verse. And I've done it, believe me. I've given some killer sermons, but what did it boil down to? I told someone what a word meant, and then I spun a whole thing about it. But that's like, that's coming at the expense of the story itself. The reason why these stories work and worked for centuries is because they're stories. And they work when you tell them to a 5-year-old and an 85-year-old. They don't even have to be explained. Just tell the Abraham narrative. See what happens. See what happened to Joseph. See what happened between Cain and Abel. I mean, how amazing is it that these two brothers fought it out and one killed the other? That's a little window into the human capacity to cause evil. There it is, right at the beginning. Just tell the story. So that's probably one level. The other level is context, which is what the first century study Bible was supposed to at least help with. What's the context? And some of that is the word means this and that. And it makes a huge difference. But it's not the only golden key. I think it's just a necessary progression out of the story. And I think the way I look at the third level, which is the most untapped, and maybe I'll write a book on it someday, is the mythopoetic reading. The deep archetypal, symbolic, metaphoric, deep structure of what these stories are only pointing toward. That's the mythopoetic level. That's taking a symbol like Christ and saying he has 12 disciples, and most people tell you, oh, that's from the 12 tribes. That is a symbol of the cosmos, of the sign of the zodiac, that this is a cosmic birth. Now, that's reading it on the level of the mythopoetic, that we're talking about the dawning of a new age here, and the entire cosmos is in cooperation. But that's about as big of a story as you can get. Or Jacob and Esau, these two brothers, one is a wild, hairy man of the forest and the desert, and the other is a little good boy that stays at home. Well, these are, a mythopoetic reading is, these are two manifestations of everyone's psyche that are at war, and they have to meet one another. You can't kick the wild man out and only be a good boy, nor can you only be a wild man and never dwell in a tent.
Wow.
You know, it's like these are just two sides of the human psyche. And I think, by the way, this mythopoetic reading is what can help redeem or change, maybe I don't like the word redeem, it's a bit overused, but help transform the Christian narrative from the inside out. Not to mention culture, and like I said, it's part of the Western psyche too.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe what we need is a much deeper reading of some of these things, rather than, like, many of my friends are, like, a secular humanist. They're like, if we could just get rid of everything, get rid of the Bible, get rid of church, it's just not going to happen. It's too deep. So you almost have to use depth to, as an agent of transformation, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it's
a little bit because these are ideas in my head. But
yeah, these are incredible. Actually, my mind's kind of blown. So the Bible, for instance, you know, I love the Bible, but I think that you have to, and I'll get emails about this, but I'm not going to get into that. But I think you almost have to, in some way, say, okay, this wasn't meant. I had AJ Levine on. I'm not sure if you're familiar with AJ, but she said, you know, the New Testament writers, these guys were not creating systematic theology. That's not what they were doing.
No way.
Yeah, and so we got to, like, take that Bible and say, okay, we've been reading this wrong the whole time, and there is a different way to look at this, and that's where I'm completely lost, dude. I'm trying to figure out how to do that. Because so many people are like, okay, well, what do you do with the verses where Jesus talks about hell? And like right now, I'm just like, I don't know, but I'm working on that.
I have an idea.
Let's hear it.
Part of it, I mean, some of it is you need some context. And that's usually where the debates begin and end. Well, actually, the word is Hades, and Hades is part of the underworld, and so this is an allusion to this. That would be kind of a liberal reading, or Gehenna or something. And then Jesus talking about Gehenna, that's a trash heap outside of Jerusalem, and really Jesus is threatening something in the present. Well, maybe. Maybe the not-so-liberal progressive reading would be something like, no, this corresponds, yeah, of course he's using Gehenna, but it corresponds to a real place. And it's to be read literally, and there'll be a separation of the sheep and the goats will be thrown in, and so forth and so on. Fine conversation to have, but when you start thinking about things on the mythopoetic level, and you start asking questions like, what is the underworld, and what is the upper world? What is the middle world, for that matter? Why, in every culture, is there a very dark place where all the unpleasant stuff gets stuffed down and scapegoated in a way, placed on other people, like the devil, like Satan, like Judas, like, and if we could just expel those elements, then the rest of us would be pure or clean or something like that. What's going on in the human psyche, and why are there multiple traditions that seem to refer to this underworld? However, given these sort of mythic dynamics, what does it teach us about the human soul or the human heart? And one of the scary things that, at least in my view, it teaches us is that something like hell is possible in the human heart. An example of it would be the 20th century and what happened in World War I and what happened in World War II and what happened in Vietnam and what happened in Iraq and what happened in Afghanistan. The human beings have the capacity. And what else are you going to call that other than darkness, devil, tempted down into that dark space? I think, so that's one thing that a place like hell, I think, symbolizes mythically. Mm-hmm. However, one of the weird things about the Jesus story, even according to the Orthodox theology, is that he descends into these places and returns. And that, to me, symbolizes the deepest kind of spiritual journey any of us are capable of, which is we stop playing these ego games, we stop pretending that we're in control of the world, that we understand God, we know the way it works. Mm-hmm. We descend into the darkness, our own personal darkness, that I too am Cain, and I'm capable of hitting my brother over the head with a stone. That's the rabbinic story. He smashes his skull in with a stone. I am capable of that. And by the way, Jesus said something like this: Don't pretend you wouldn't have shed blood, the blood of the prophets, had you lived in those days. That's a hint of where you have to go, taking up your cross and descending there, saying, "Yep, these elements." And down in the underworld, you also discover that's not only who you are. You know, it's not just darkness. That hidden behind some of those shadowy components are often gifts. And that's the story of the return. Jesus descends and returns, having been dirty and clean, but wounded by the earth, or by the world, by humanity, by culture, by the Romans, comes back a transformed person. I think, to me, that's the essence of the kind of transformative journey that Christianity is inviting people to on the level of the mythopoetic. It almost doesn't matter what you believe, or say you believe about theological words or doctrines. If you've gone on such a journey where you have descended even into your own dark places and been rearranged, as Jesus says, 3 days and three nights in the belly of the whale, that's the sign of Jonah. You have to go down, be consumed in the stomach of something in order to be vomited out and be of any help, discovering both your own wounds and your own gifts. So this requires a whole, and probably something other than me just talking out loud on the phone, but
it's awesome, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, anyway. it's so like alien to, you know what I mean? To your average person, that, you know, most people don't ever get the opportunity even to go this deep into it. It's reminds me of kind of like St. John's Dark Night of the Soul, or you know what I'm talking about?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah, so
that's the journey. It requires some darkness, and the sad thing is that, well, maybe it's not even a sad thing. Maybe it's what rules and tradition has to do. When the rules and tradition say something like, stay put, don't move, don't challenge, don't think for yourself, trust us, we know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're in that cauldron long enough, and especially if you have a few real encounters with suffering, your own or someone close to you, and you realize this thing has limits. And
yeah,
all of a sudden you wake up one day and you are in the dark night. You didn't even choose it. It's just life happened to you. And the great news is you're in good company. That's the Jesus narrative. That's the garden saying, hey, if there's another way, please. Or that's Jesus on the cross saying, you have forsaken.
Mm-hmm.
Being abandoned by who you thought God was, that's the dark night. And I don't know if everybody needs to go on it. I can't make such a universal claim, but I do think that's the way people change.
Man, I think everybody has to deal with it on some level. I think a lot of us, like, you know, for years, you just sort of like shove it down and I don't want to deal with this, and it's wrong to think this, and it's, but sooner or later, man, whether it's on your deathbed or somewhere, I don't know, sooner or later that comes back up to, you know, it's always there saying, hey, you got to deal with me at some point. I mean, I think everybody,
exactly.
Some people, maybe they don't ever actually get there, but a healthy spiritual growth, I think requires, yeah, exactly what you're talking about.
I think so too, and the tradition does actually say that. The Bible itself and the saints and mystics all say something like that. Even sometimes I think about Peter. Peter is such a complex figure, and I almost take like his denial of Jesus to be the doorway. Like when people deny Jesus, I think great, good, exactly. Don't put on a pretty face anymore. Say, I don't believe any of this. It's all bullshit. That's the denial that opens up the possibility for something else. I guarantee you people aren't going to stay that in that place. Now, maybe they won't come back to their, you know, tradition or the Christianity that they had as a kid. I'm not going back to evangelical Christianity, mm-hmm. as far as I'm aware of. But something like the denial, it becomes this ironic opening. You think it's going to be the end. I've hit the wall. I don't even know who this guy is anymore. And then, you know, it something else opens up. The rooster crows. I'm, again, reading mythically or mythopoetically. The rooster crows. And the rooster crowing is one, the soul waking up, saying, ah, that's right. There's something else. But you can't do it without the denial. Anyway, so Yeah, when people lose their faith, I think, good, they're just getting going.
It's so hard, though, man.
Not that I would force anybody to do that. But it just seems to be the way the story is, the deep human story.
Yeah, that's a hard place to be in when you... most of your Christian experience has been based on knowing, you know, I mean, man, in the Assemblies of God, we had 16 fundamental truths. It's like, we know these 16 things. Absolutely. You know, and then you get to this place where you're like, okay, a big part of my experience or my spiritual existence is not knowing. And that's hard to get used to, man.
It is. But it's a vast plane, you know. It's humbling, and there's nothing humble about 16 fundamental truths. That's just, and I don't even say it's wrong. It's just that's the way the ego works. There's no humility in that. But until you're leveled, and even if like only 15 work, but the 16th doesn't, that's the beginning of a leveling, you know. And like you're saying, the unknowing, and that was what was surprising to me. With the cataphatic and adiphatic stuff, I realized there's an entire Christian tradition based on not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the Cloud of Unknowing, he says, if you want to get going on the deeper spiritual life, you must forget what you know and enter the cloud. Yeah. Now, that is advice from a priest. I think it's it's written in English. So this is an English mystic. It doesn't even have to be translated from, the word in Greek means no. This is written in English. But think about that as advice. Okay, I've learned these 16 things, or I've learned the 10 commandments, or I've learned the Romans Road, whatever it happens to be, I know it. And now I've reached the end of this so-called knowing, and something is inviting me, what if there's more? And the invitation, according to the cloud, is to forget what you know. Enter the cloud of forgetfulness and begin to let it go. That's what contemplation is. You start to have open hands instead of a closed fist that's rooted in fear. And then you're led where you don't want to go, you know? That's like Peter. The final thing that Jesus says to Peter, he says, you'll be led where you don't want to go. A mystical reading of that is, you're going to be led now instead of insisting you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if we just told people that, we'd have a sense of the arc.
Right.
It's not one or the other, okay? Maybe there's a place for tradition. I actually think there's a place for the doctrine. Some of them I don't happen to think are very helpful. But let's take the incarnation. You can argue about that all day. As a symbol, it's a needed symbol. And it's rooted in a kind of orthodoxy. But there's also the forgetting of that kind of orthodoxy. It just gets you going on the road by giving you a symbol and an image that... okay, God is not somewhere else. He's present and in this person. And then you start asking, and where else is God present? Where else is God incarnated? And then you're on the road. Then you're being led, even where you don't want to go. So
wow, man, I have got to. I would love to have you come back sometime and talk about it. What is it called? It's mythopoetical.
Mythopoetic is what I'm calling it. A mythopoetic reading.
That's amazing. Fascinating.
Myth, by the way, myth gets a bad rap. I mean, as soon as you say myth, people think, oh, that means it's not true. No, a myth is a story that is deeply true, but not necessarily historical.
Mm-hmm.
And it uses metaphor, symbol, and poetry to communicate that. That's the story of Genesis. I don't think Adam and Eve were real people who walked around. I actually think the story is more true than a historical fact.
Deeper.
So when someone says the Bible's a myth, I honestly think, thank you. What a lovely compliment. You mean it's among the greatest works of literature that human beings have ever uttered? Yes. Thank you. We should definitely read more of it, not less of it.
Yeah. Wow. All right, man. So let's talk about... so there's Bitten by a Camel, which is an incredible book. Then there's the NIV First Century Bible, which is basically giving culture. Like you said, it explains a few of those words that are... Actually, it's really... I love that thing, man. I I heard you talking about it on the, I think on the Robcast, and I thought, man, I got to check that out. It's phenomenal. It's just really incredible. But tell me, what else are you up to right now?
Well, I'm teaching at this place called C3. It's an inclusive spiritual community. They don't really have a doctrine. It's not a place I invented, but I just started a relationship with them. So I do some teaching out there. It's in Grand Haven, Michigan, near my house. And I'm pretty deep into some work at a place called Animus Valley Institute in Colorado, which is essentially like almost like a kind of ecotherapy. It's not really the language we use, but taking small groups of people out back at, out into nature and doing psychospiritual work, facilitating conversations between who they think they are and what's going on in their lives. And so anyway, I've been deep in that kind of work, going to wild places, and I'm in a kind of training program there, and I also lead trips to Israel. I still really, really love that. I thought, you know, not being a mega church pastor anymore, that would kind of dry up, but people still want to go, and I really love it. It's like, it's a pilgrimage, it's so we go, we wander, we explore, we ask questions, and I find all kinds of people can go, from the fundamentalist to the agnostic, you know, and we still have things that culture, history, language, Bible, and modern politics, it's just like, it's a lovely stew of all these things. So I do some trips to Israel, and I just started another book, but
oh, cool.
Can't really say much about it because I don't know how it's going to unfold. But yeah, so sometimes I lead my own retreats. By the way, I do a few things around here, not too often, but I have my own retreats and programs, really to help people who are in a season of unraveling themselves. Instead of trying to keep that from happening, but maybe help a healthy version of descent and unraveling is kind of the work that I feel most drawn to, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and so how do people find you online?
Yeah, my website, Ken Dobson, whatever it is, kendobson.com.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I don't know, I'm sure you do Facebook and Twitter and all that kind of stuff as well, right?
I thought of a tweet the other day, which was, I forgot about Twitter. Like, other than when I hear stuff from the president, I remember, oh yeah, there's a thing called Twitter, so I'm not really on there, although I'll tweet something. But yeah, I'm on Facebook.
Yep.
I don't really use it like, I use it to look for things that are for sale instead of Craigslist, and occasionally I read the feed. But I put my stuff out there, and also C3's, the teachings I do on a sort of biweekly basis, I'll throw up there too. So
yeah, dude. Hey, man, thank you so much for coming on. This is absolutely fascinating, and I would love to have you on again to talk about some of those other things. It's
sure.
Mind-blowing, man. It just really is incredible. But anyway,
I
man.
I appreciate you reading the book and asking me questions about it.
Oh, it's great.
It means a lot. I didn't write a book. I mean, some of it was just for my own well-being. I felt like I got to say this stuff at a certain point, but I'm trying to be helpful. And even if people find just anecdotes or one chapter helpful, I think... That's a good thing.
Some of it's deeply personal, and I took it that way, and it really, you know, it touches some of those places where you go, okay, well, I'm not ready to deal with that one right now, but I know it's there, I'm just not ready to handle it yet. it's really brilliant, man. It's a great book.
Hey,
so anyway, man, thank you so much. Man, I really appreciate it, and I'll be in touch with you soon, and see if we can't get you back on again, if that's cool.
All right, yeah, thanks a lot.
All right, man, thanks, Kent. See you, buddy.
All right, yeah, take care.
All right, guys, thanks for hanging out with me today, man. What a cool conversation. What a good dude, man. We had a great time talking, and I'm so thankful that Kent was on. Just a just a good dude, man. So lots of great things to say. I'm going to try and have him on again soon so we can talk about some more things. Let me know what you thought of the podcast. Jump online. Let me know what you thought about today's episode. And go check out Kent's stuff, man. Brilliant guy. So that's it, guys. Thanks for hanging out with me today. Love you guys. Bless you guys. Done.